Okay, so this starts our penultimate session of the day on new GTLDs, with the last session of the day being the fair of sorts in which anybody proposing a GTLD can have a chance to explain things and kind of wander around. During this panel, they will be setting up a liquor dispensary outside for which if you give them money, they will give you alcohol. And the idea will be that after the panel, or perhaps depending on how things turn out, in the middle of the panel, you can go out and drink, and then come back in and enjoy your drinks, talk amongst yourselves after the panel, and also learn about some of the various TLDs that have been proposed, at least from those who have decided among the TLD applicants to come and explain them. So that's the battle plan, and why don't we just jump right in and start with this panel. We have... I don't know if there's some significance to the seating that has taken place. One of these is not
like... He just did that on his own. I think there is.
Okay, so we have somebody who's off in the corner here, Louis Tuton, General Counsel of ICANN. Louis, welcome again.
Thank
back
you.
For more punishment, as it were. Thank you for your participation on this morning's panel. Louis, let me just start with you and give us as briefly as you can a sense of what's going to happen this week, so far as you know. What is going to happen this week on the subject of new TLDs?
Well, I think it's likely to be nearly as much of a surprise to me as to all of you. But just mechanically, in the wee hours of Friday morning last week, an evaluation team issued a report which is available on the web. And at the same time, we established a additional web-based comment forum to talk about the evaluation report and anything else about the applications. Also on Wednesday, at the ICANN in-person public forum, virtually the entire afternoon will be devoted to comments from the audience, applicants, the public, constituencies. About the TLD applications, the evaluation report, the new TLD program, anything like that. And the matter will be presented to the ICANN board on Thursday with the hope that they will, at that time, make some selections.
So the idea is they will inherit this report that was released last week, and they'll be able to digest the comments that happened in the public comment forum, and maybe at some point we can throw the public comment forum up on the screen just to see how that is shaping up. And then there'll be more talk this week, and then your hope is that one of the orders of business at the Thursday board meeting, which I gather is an open meeting, people can come and watch a discussion happen, and then at some point somebody will make a motion that says, I move that such and such a company be told that it is in the running to be negotiated with to get a new domain if the negotiations are successful. That's the kind of thing that will happen.
That's what the board resolutions contemplate, yes. And then, as you point out, then there would be a negotiation process. The current target date to complete is the end of the year.
Gotcha. And how many applications total were received?
44 were active.
44 were active, you say?
Yeah, there are two of them, one of them was withdrawn, and two of them failed to make the payment, the application fee.
There's an application fee. Yeah, I come from a university. You know, $50, you get your application for admission, unless you plead hardship. Here it was $50,000, gets you an entry, and you can propose as many TLDs as you wanted in a given application. Is that right? The $50,000 was sort of all you can eat?
Yes, you could have multiple TLDs, although one applicant, for example, exactly the same applicant, presented two applications and paid two fees.
And what was that applicant smoking?
Well, it's $50,000 per application, and the requirement is that all of the TLD strings be treated the same way in the application.
I see.
So, for example, if you were having, you know, just looking at examples at the back of the room, .air is was proposed as a narrow chartered domain by SITA, and .biz I see right there iDomains, for example, proposed that. Those are very different domains, and it's hard to believe you would have the same pro forma financial projections and registry structure for those two things. So that would have to be two applications.
I see. So one application says, across all of these domains, this is how we'll run it and how, what we expect, et cetera, et cetera. And you can grant us any or all of those domains under the terms that we specify in our application. That was the idea.
That's the idea, yeah.
Gotcha. And did anybody actually say, we'll do anything? You tell us what name to run, we're just ready to do it.
No. Everybody had an idea.
Gotcha. And some had more than one.
But many had more than one.
Okay. So we had no way of actually having each of the entities proposing new top-level domains easily on a single in-person panel. And that's why I don't want to do too much is emphasize particular applications, especially by we have a few applicants here on the panel. I don't necessarily want that to mean you're here to talk about your proposals per se. But we're hoping that in some way, I hate to use words like representation, you're here to share a little of your experience as applicants on the process that has gone before and what you're expecting to have happen as the week unfolds. So let me just start with Richard Foreman. Richard Foreman, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us why you think you're here.
Okay. Thanks, John. Well, I'm here because you invited me to be here.
That was the right answer.
I'm president and CEO of Register.com, and Register.com has been a live competitive registrar now for over a year and a half, and we submitted two bids. We're a participant in the affiliates bid, which is a consortium of 19 registrars that are working together to create a competitive, generic, open, top-level domain. And I'm also a participant in the Registry Pro Bid. And the Registry Pro Bid is a consortium with Virtual Internet in the UK, as well as some assistance from Baltimore Technologies, in order to provide a .pro registry, which is specifically targeted at professionals, whether they be lawyers or doctors or accountants, specifically targeted at accredited professionals on a worldwide basis.
Gotcha. So Affilius is a separate company which itself comprises registrars?
Affilius is a separate organization sponsored by and funded by registrars.
Gotcha.
So they don't. It's not an umbrella organization for the registrars. Rather, it's a separate consortium that the registrars are funding, sponsoring, and working together to create a competitive, open, top-level domain.
And is it a for-profit or a non-profit consortium?
It's a little bit of both. The way that
501c3 and a half, they say in the United States.
No easy answers. It's a combination of both. The registrars that contribute funds to Affilius are able to participate in the equity of Affilius. However, it is open, and as new registrars become accredited, those new registrars can participate in Affilius. So it's effectively a for-profit model, but that the registrars can join at any time. In addition, there is a rebate provision so that part of the proceeds and part of the profit is returned to all accredited registrars based upon the cumulative level of registration.
Sort of the Discover Card model.
It's very similar.
Yeah. Okay, so Affilius has accredited registrars in it. New accredited registrars can join. And by accredited registrar, we mean those accredited for .com, .net, and .org registrations?
Yeah, well, that's the definition that ICANN has developed, which is if it's accredited by ICANN.
Gotcha. And the idea is that a registrar can join, pony up some money, get some pro rata equity in Affilius, and Affilius then will be a registry?
Affilius is the registry. However, Affilius the registry is outsourcing some of the functions for the back end. But Affilius is the registry in that it is setting policy, it is managing the organization, and all of the constituent members get to elect a management organization that manages the registry.
My Lord. Okay. Very interesting. So how has your experience been so far of this application process? You're somebody that's been around for a few years. You've been registering names as a registrar. Is this pretty much what you expected would shape up?
Well, this is ICANN, so a lot of it hasn't been what I expected, but it's been in a very grassroots, democratic manner. I think that the affiliates bid really does represent a lot of the collective wishes and a lot of the collective good, in that all the registrars are working together to try and create a competitive registry that's going to be successful. And I think that given the fact that there are so many registrars involved with it, and given that they have already demonstrated success with over 25 million generic top-level domains, it bodes very well for the affiliates registry as being a true competitive open registry.
Uh-huh. But I meant as far as the ICANN process goes, for example, one could have imagined that there would be some referral to the DNSO, and the DNSO would haggle for a while over it, and then inconclusive, put a report back to the board. You know, there could be pieces of the puzzle that don't seem to be present. Right now it's, you pay your $50,000, you submit an application, ICANN staff thinks hard, gives a report, public comment, out to the board, decision made, negotiation, start registering.
Well, I think that when you look at ICANN, ICANN has a pretty clear mission in terms of creating competitive, or opening up the internet names and addressing space and making a competitive environment. And I think as you look back on the history of ICANN, they've done a very good job of doing that on the registrar level. And this is sort of the next step in the evolution, which is doing it on the registry level. And in terms of trying to get it done, many of the members of the group are involved with the DNSO. And I know that there is a lot of, this is not being done in a way that's in the shadows. This is being done very much in the light. And there's a lot of opportunity for people to understand what's going on. So I think that overall, a lot of the different supporting organizations should be very comfortable, because many of the issues that were their concern throughout the process leading up to the resolution at the last ICANN meeting were specifically addressed in the affiliates proposal.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. Chris Ambler, tell us about yourself.
Scale large mountains. Forget what that joke is about the...
Was that college application?
College application. Yeah. I performed three impossible tasks before breakfast.
Yes, Ben will have it up on the screen in an alarming period of time.
I'm the chief technology officer and one of the founders of Image Online Design. We are also proposing an open, unrestricted top-level domain that we have been running for just under 5 years now, which is .web.
And when you say running for 5 years, it means you've taken registrations and you are entered in some root zones, so that if my browser is pointed to resolve DNS through a given root zone that doesn't happen to be the one that has become ICANN's, I can find your .web address.
You don't even need a root zone. You can just point directly to our servers and say, go find .web from them. Just like you could point directly to network solution servers and say, go find .com from them.
Gotcha.
If you want. But.
And how many .web names have you registered so far?
Over 20,000.
Gotcha.
So far over the past 5 years.
And how does your experience with the process match to how Richard has described it in the past year or so?
It's been similar. I will echo his comment with ICANN. You never know what's going to happen. It's a learning experience as you go along. I'm not quite sure. I mean, there's so much I could say. You want to narrow me down a little bit?
An unexpected invitation. Yeah. Well, we're at a process point for which there's been a staff report that's come out. And let's just put it out on the table. Is it your sense that the board will meet with an open mind, read the materials, and do what a good board should do, think hard, talk amongst themselves, take a vote, and then we have the answer?
Is it my sense that they will do that? I would hope that they would do something similar. I would hope that they would read the report, although I should throw the caveat in there, but that they will deliberate in the open, that it will be fair and open and transparent. We've heard all these words before, and we'll move forward. And I have to take a position of optimism and say that I hope this will happen. Now, the caveat that I'm going to throw in is that the staff report was just a little concerned, because there were a number of factual inaccuracies, but we've corrected them. We've posted it to the public comment board, which presumably the ICANN board reads, and hopefully throughout this process we'll be approved for negotiation. We can continue to educate the ICANN board about the truth of the issues and move forward.
Sounds good. Kerry Karp, tell us about yourself.
I am here most immediately, I presume, as the president of the newly formed Museum Domain Management Association. which is, I believe, not quite 2 months old at this point, which was created specifically towards the end of submitting a proposal for a dedicated domains of museum community by the International Council of Museums, an organization of some 52 years standing, and the John Paul Getty Trust. ICOM has acted throughout the course of its history to ensure that the public derives maximum benefit from the museum community, to ensure that action that might serve to the detriment of either the museum community or the public is avoided. And when the notion of expanding top-level domain space was first articulated, it occurred to us immediately, given that there is a cyber extension of the activity that I just described, that here is yet something else that could be harnessed either to the advantage of the museum community as it attempts to establish an identity, collective identity for itself on the internet. And it's also something that would enable exploitive powers to act all the more exploitively.
What are the exploitive powers?
The multimedia industry perceives tremendous value, as indeed there is, in the content that what are called the memory institutions, libraries, archives, museums, possess. And there have been any number of deals made where for short-term obvious cash benefit, you sign over to us the rights to utilizing your material in digital context.
This is the Bettman Archives story.
Yes, quite specifically. And there are any number of agencies that have responded to this threat. And the notion of a dedicated museum domain promises both some protection from action of that sort, and it also promises greater threat of such action. So something needs to be done. If the museum community...
Sounds like the end of a Newsweek article.
Oh, right? Whatever.
The future is uncertain, but one thing is clear. If things don't get better, they could get a whole lot worse.
It is clear that things will change. It is clear that there is some consequence of this action, and we can either passively see what that might be, or we can act proactive. We can be proactive to nudge it in the direction that we want. The conclusion being from the point of view of the International Council of Museums, that is, that if there is to be a dedicated museum domain, ever, and it is to be to some benefit to the museum community that there is one, then the museum community must articulate the policy of this domain. And ICANN has stipulated a process by which these notions can be read into the record, and here we are now doing exactly that. If there were to be if the zero option were to have been adopted, there will be no new top-level domains, not now, not ever, or as an alternative, there will never be a museum domain. That's fine. You know. But if there's the slightest notion that there might be a museum domain, if not now, then 2 years from now, unless the museum community does whatever it possibly can to ensure a decisive influence on the policy of that domain, we are being derelict in our duty. And we mean nothing more, nothing less in all of this than the six-letter string, M-U-S-E-U-M, which anybody can purchase, any individual or any agency can purchase in a domain designation, thereby meaning absolutely nothing. Yeah. If we wish there to be some reserved corner of domain name space where M-U-S-E-U-M does mean something, then we feel that a top-level domain with a clearly articulated, clearly defined charter would be an excellent means for achieving precisely that end.
Gotcha. So you say the process has started, the museum community wants to step up to the plate and claim .museum as its own so that somebody else that's just more generically into registering names doesn't grab .museum and then turn to you and set the policy.
Anyone who's generically interested in registering names is more than welcome to be a party to this. We're simply saying that if there is... I realize that the notion of introducing semantic value into the DNS is enormously contentious. And without, at this point, at least saying how I personally feel about that, and clearly the word, the letter string museum means something. It ought to mean something. And if the community, if the users of the network are to be able to associate any meaning with museum, then there has to be a document on record someplace which says what that means. And ICOM, during the course of its 52 years, has devised a definition of the notion of museum anchored in its global constituency, which is almost invariably trotted out when national legislation is contemplated relevant to museums. You are a museum if you are in adherence with the ICOM definition of museum, which is astonishingly broad. I think most of you will be surprised if you were to read it in detail. And the only thing that the Museum Domain Management Association hopes to be able to achieve in all of this is putting that definition of museum into the definitive position in that museum, who actually does everything else is almost, not almost secondary, it is secondary. I mean,
so just to take this for one more second, I'm unfamiliar with some of the politics, if there are any, of the museum community. Is there sort of a sibling museum organization that relates to you in some way that, you know, the Police Benevolent Association always has the Brotherhood of Police? And
there are any number of museum associations which may in fact be overtly competing with each other on national and regional levels. But in terms of the international arena, the International Council of Museums is it. It is one of the non-governmental organizations that was spawned in the post-World War II period when the United Nations was busy gearing up, and it's had responsibility as the highest, what would be the word, discussion forum in the international arena for issues relevant to museum politics, museums as they relate to the public. And it is, in fact, undisputed. There's no agency of which I'm aware, and I've never heard in the course of this discussion or any other, that there's a candidate. So in terms of representing the international museum community, yes, indeed, ICOM perceives itself and feels itself to be perceived as unique.
Gotcha. All right, Steve, tell us about yourself.
I'm Steve Metallitz, and I'm not here to advocate for the adoption of any particular new top-level domain. I'm here on behalf of the intellectual property constituency of the DNSO, one of the groups that has been looking at all of these applications and trying to make sense of them, organize them, and evaluate them.
You've come up with your own scorecard, right?
Yes, we have. We posted on our website I guess about 3 or 4 months ago, which is almost ancient history in ICANN terms, the criteria that we thought were most important to consider in terms of recognizing new top-level domains. And we took the position that the number of domains or even the type of domain was not the most important question. The most important question was the ground rules under which the domain would operate. Since then, those criteria have been endorsed by the business constituency of the DNSO and also by the ISP constituency of the DNSO. But our constituency has also tried to apply those criteria to the 44 applications that Louis spoke of, and give our best evaluation of at least that aspect of the new TLD application process that's of most concern directly to us.
So, not having reviewed it so much myself, I guess I would hazard a guess that at least high on your list of issues would be whether a new proposed registry would agree to, through its registrars, implement something like the existing uniform dispute resolution policy that now is there for ComNet and org. I guess that might be one thing, and the other might be this Oklahoma land rush problem and how that gets solved.
Well, there are a number of issues. I mean, the dispute resolution is one of them. There needs to be a method for dealing with disputes that will arise. It's important that registrants provide accurate contact data and keep it current. It's important that that data be accessible to the public through a WHOIS service. It's important that we have a mechanism for avoiding the land rush problem, or at least trying to protect the land rush problem against cyber squatting through some type of sunrise provision or some other method. We also look at those applications which were chartered TLDs, restricted TLDs, such as the museum one, to look at how was the charter defined and what were the enforcement mechanisms. And then compliance is also one of our criteria. How can we be sure, or what will be the mechanism for ensuring that new TLDs operate the way they say they're going to operate in the application?
So, for example, Richard, as you helped develop the proposals, be they for .biz through Afilias or .pro through the other organization, to what extent were the kinds of concerns that Steve just put out something that really influenced your framing of the proposal?
Well, for sure, in both applications, we're very sensitive to the intellectual property concerns. So there are two provisions that exist in both of the applications which go a long way, we believe, towards addressing some of those concerns. First off, there's a sunrise period. During that sunrise period, trademark holders are given the opportunity to reserve their name in advance of opening up the namespace to other registrants. So if you're a bona fide trademark holder and you're able to confirm that, you get the chance to apply for a domain name.
Once do you care about Famous Marks versus, you know, Jack's Barbecue in Memphis once Jack's.biz?
To the best of my knowledge, there is no discrimination between those in these applications. That it is based on, if there's a registered trademark, that gets you in the game. And then the second part of it is that after the sunrise period is over, there is a land rush or a round robin process by which people that have the names, that want names, enter into a queue, and then the various registrars are given access to reserving names on a round robin basis, so that
it's kind of like an NFL draft or something. It's very your turn, registrar. Now it's your turn. You get one name.
It's very similar to that. So we believe that those proposals help address some of those concerns. And in both proposals, the UDRP, identical to what's currently in existence for the generic top-level domain space, is going to be implemented on both proposals.
And just to clarify, too, in this complex relationship between ICANN, registry, registrars, and other organizations in the middle, would it be the place of the registry, should it be awarded the contract, to tell the registrars, you are only to charge X amount per name? If we catch you charging more, out you go as an accredited registrar for us or something. Or is that ICANN's job to do?
Yeah, and in terms of you're saying if a registrar starts competing on price or is prohibited from competing on price?
Well, I guess in the round-robin process, whoever gets pick number one would be in a position to beat the other registrars out to a given name.
Correct.
And thus could not have competition for that one name if that's the pick they want to do.
Well, but assuming that there is, the registrar is doing it on behalf of a registrant. So the registrar is reserving that name based upon a request from a registrant. It's not the registrar reserving it for their own use. So the registrars, it's going to be a round robin for the registrars, and I don't think that the issue of pricing restrictions by the registry or by ICANN are necessarily appropriate. It should be a competitive space.
So if I'm just a would-be registrant, and I don't have any trademarks to speak of, I've looked all over and I can't find any, so I've just decided I want sex.biz. That might be useful to me. At least as a resale value, if not something personally fulfilling.
Yeah, sure.
And I want to come to the registrar. I go to register.com, I guess. And I would say, I want sex.biz. And you'd say, there's going to be a round-robin process, and somebody that has a trademark on sex will first get a chance. And if nobody steps forward, then you'll be in a random lottery, and the other 8 million people that want sex, somebody will win.
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't want sex, right?
Is only 8 million wants sex?
Only for biz.
In terms of how the registrants are... it's a great example, Jonathan.
It's funny, it was spontaneous.
The way that registrants are going to approach it, obviously there's going to be a communication period because this process has never been implemented before in the namespace, at least in the generic namespace, where we have to communicate. We as registrars have to go out there and explain to businesses and individuals across the gamut how is it going to work. First, trademark holders get a chance in terms of the sunrise period, and then beyond that, there is an open process. But there will not be necessarily real-time registrations for the initial period. That is a change from the current way that registrations work.
In other words, instead of being first come, first serve, there's some period where everybody can step forward and say they want it, and then a close on the period and a lottery, and away we go.
Well, it's important to remember the first come, first serve concepts still apply, which means if two people have the same registered trademark, then there's on a first come, first serve basis, except to the extent that UDRP may kick in, which may not be applicable. But there is a first come, first serve nature, assuming that everyone has the same rights.
Crystal clear. So Jack's Barbecue at 12:01 a.m. and 52 seconds on the day that you open registrations for Jack's.biz, for anything.biz, in this sunrise period, gets ahead of Jack's Seafood, and that would be...
Well, let me ask a question. Do they both have the registered trademark?
Yeah.
For what?
One for fish and one for...
No, but is it Jack?
Yeah.
So they both have the registered trademark Jack. So it's
yeah,
not Jack's Barbecue, it's Jack. They both want Jack.
They both want
Jack.
See, it's always a surprise, right? You didn't expect this out of the panel. Yes, they both want checks.
First come, first serve. Except to the extent that one of them wants to invoke a UDRP.
Right. So there'll be sort of the sunrise period, then there'll be the proto-litigation period of the UDRP, then there'll be the lawsuits.
No, there'll be UDRP, and that should be the end of it.
That should be the end of it.
That's right.
Gotcha. So the panel we saw this morning, there's a lot more business coming the way of these UDRP providers than Milton's graphs might indicate.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think that the UDRP process, at least from our perspective, has worked pretty well. I think that the ratio in terms of the number of registrations that actually get subject to UDRP is really a fraction of the total of number of registrations that we do. So with all of the, you know, criticism of UDRP that exists out there, there is a process by which these issues get resolved.
Right.
Of course, some people may never be happy, no matter how far you take it.
Right.
But UDRP goes a long way to try and create clarity where there was none.
So this is another data point. Chris, is this pretty much how your proposal would have it work too?
No.
How would yours do it?
We would remove all of that. And we say first come, first serve, as it has been in RFC 1591 since the beginning.
And is this prospectively, or this includes grandfathering all the prior people who have registered for .web with you?
The people who have registered with us registered in good faith over the past 5 years. We are an operating registry. We have applied to ICANN for an approval of that registry into the roots. Nothing more.
So that means it would be grandfathered.
I think grandfathering is the wrong term, but our registry would be entered into the roots. There are already approximately 20,000 registrations in it, and that's what would happen.
And they might then be subject to the UDRP process?
They are in fact subject to the UDRP process. The one change that we have made is that upon approval, we will freeze registrations and allow anyone to bring a UDRP proceeding against any registration already in the database. And if it's successful, as one would think it would be if you have a good case, we make the change. We embrace the UDRP because it's what we've got. It seems to be working. It definitely needs some work. ICANN has said it needs some work. We're prepared to work on it. We've got some ideas on how it can be better.
And Carrie, I'm trying to imagine, would it be a crush of museums trying to get into .museum? There's a multiple Guggenheims.
I know those terms, but certainly hope so. And indeed, the naming principle is one of the issues that remains for us to resolve. We wish for museums to be recognizable in their choice of name string, so one of the requirements is that the string you request has to be obviously derivable from your name. There are as many national galleries as there are countries, and the notion of awarding national.museum on a first-come, first-served basis, although an easy way out, appears to us at this point to be counter to our ultimate purpose. It doesn't really inject terribly much meaning into all of this. And we envision at the outset a process whereby individual museums are registered on the third level, and there is a second level which provides that uniqueness, a generic or a regional designator.
Guggenheim.newyork.museum.
For example, right? And the potential registrant base will be encouraged to propose name strings which, were they registered on the second level, would provide enough global uniqueness that the first come, first serve effect wouldn't be the predominant one.
Gotcha.
And should that be the case, should it turn out that we've insisted upon a generic second level unnecessarily, that it's redundant, then at the end of the proof of concept, we can begin to discuss notions of compacting namespace.
Gotcha.
But that would be a type example of the sort of thing that would need to be discussed in any negotiation about the creation of the domain.
Gotcha.
Do we want to have a naming principle engraved in granite from the outset? Again, there are the alternatives. The first come, first serve makes life very easy, but it renders the domain less semantically valuable than it otherwise would be.
Right. Louis, as somebody who presumably has read most, if not all, of these proposals, is what we're hearing here representative of the applications? Which is to say, are most of these applications ones that are going to embrace, if not a uniform dispute resolution policy in particular, the UDRP, they're going to have some method of not just making it all the hogs come to the trough and start slurping?
I think it's fair to say that most, nearly all of the applications embrace some form of the UDRP, usually just straight out of the box.
of course, subject to whatever reforms.
So Steve's probably pretty happy. I mean, he's getting...
Well, if you're viewing that the trademark and intellectual property community is entirely happy with the UDRP, you're forgetting the fact that once the UDRP was written, they went right to Congress and got a law passed.
That too. Half a loaf here, half a loaf here.
But in terms of the startup, the land rush problem, there's a broad variety of different approaches. There's with all sorts of names that aren't particularly descriptive often, sunrise, daybreak, other things. I don't know where the names come from.
So one can't help but wonder, with all this going on as we're expanding the generic namespace, where does this leave the country codes? Right, we've got
Over at the courtyard right now.
They're over at the courtyard right now. So while they're distracted with the liquor, fill us in. What's the deal with the country codes? Is there ever going to be, from what you can tell, is there anything to indicate whether they too will end up with some form of UDRP, or can they, if they choose, just be completely open, as some are?
About a dozen. Slightly more, I think, now have adopted the informed dispute resolution policy or a minor variation of it. They're in their current policy, they're free to establish whatever policies they seem fit. A lot of them are looking at either the dispute resolution policy or some variant. Canada and Japan, for example, recently have ongoing processes in that way.
Gotcha. Steve, can you tell us how much the country codes figure into the things that you worry about in your institutional capacity?
They figure in very much, and we think that a similar criteria to the ones we've proposed in the new TLD space ought to apply, we would hope, in the CCTLD space eventually. If I can comment on the UDRP issue, it's true that a lot of the applications do make a reference to the UDRP, but it's not always clear how they expect that to be applied. For example, it's one thing for the UDRP to apply, as it does now, I think as we heard earlier today, to a small slice of egregious cyber-squatting type issues, not to trademark conflicts generally, because it doesn't apply to that. It's another thing to say that it would also be applied to problems of charter violations and a lot of other issues that some of these applications, anyway, would seem to think that the UDRP is a magic phrase and that will take care of any problems that might arise through the lack of a definition of a charter or a lack of restrictions as to who can register.
I suppose, though, that if I'm proposing a registry that has some kind of limit, I guess Richard maybe could talk about .pro, right, the professional one. Somebody's going to have to verify that so-and-so is a lawyer so that so-and-so can go under lawyer.pro. Is that right, or you just...
That's correct. There is a verification process so that people, or rather the applicants for the TLD will be approved. And the application speaks to the fact that we're going to work with the different affiliation groups to make sure that the verification is done for that professional organization or that professional type in a way that's consistent with that organization.
Or and is rather, the idea, though, that the ultimate arbiter of this is going to have to be the registrant? You can't punt the UDRP people? You got some arbitrators. Just tell them, here's a new set of rules. Now give us a decision.
I'm not familiar with that part of the application.
I think what's remarkable, you didn't ask me, Jonathan, what was surprising to us about this process, but one thing that surprises me is how many of the applications really are for unrestricted or open TLDs, whether they call themselves that or not. I think the majority of them are. And the ones that are really restricted or chartered, such as .museum, for example, are kind of in the minority. And the IPC has always questioned whether we really need more generic, wide-open TLDs. We've got several of them already. And what need is really being met by that?
And
when you look at, for example,
what's the harm of more of them?
Well, one harm is that some of them are flying under false flags. We have the phenomenon now of proposed personal name TLDs, which are open and unrestricted TLDs, as far as anybody can tell.
So you can non-people could get names.
Absolutely, and some of them probably will. I mean, these are TLDs where anybody can register anything and do anything in that space, and that to me defines an open TLD. And this suggestion that they shouldn't have to live by the same rules, for example, with regard to who is, doesn't strike me as sensible.
Yeah, of course, at least under American laws, we know corporations are people too under the 14th Amendment, but maybe that's not personal the way
the name might be intended.
Well, I mean, some of the business-oriented TLDs, for example, have, I think, really minimal or nominal tests that would have to be met. For example, the idea that you have to show in the United States a taxpayer ID number in order to establish your bona fides as a business, I think that falls far short of really creating any restrictions. So what surprises me is the extent to which so many of these applications are really generic open TLD applications. And I think to the extent that they are, if ICANN is going to approve them, we have a track record now with, you know, UDRP, with WHOIS obligations, with obligations for accurate contact data and so forth, and those certainly must apply, at least as a starting point, to these new TLDs.
Gotcha. Dave, tell us who you are in whatever of many hats you might wear that's there on this panel.
Dave Crocker, Brandenburg Consulting. I've been involved with Internet technical work standard side for a long time. The sequence that brought us to sit here today began, I guess, about 5 years ago. A little bit before that, I had some technical oversight in the Internet standards arena for domain name standards. But about 2 years after the beginning of the sequence here, a fellow named John Postel named me to a committee that was going to resolve all this.
This is the GTLD MOU committee,
the Internet Ad Hoc Committee,
the IAHC.
The best name any committee has ever had. And we produced the GTDLD chief. Okay, the best name any report has ever had. And I was the editor for that report.
And just as a curiosity, is it still possible to sign the GTLD MOU? Could I go still sign that thing?
I have no idea.
I think the ICU has it. It's vault somewhere.
And in the scheme of activities involved in the debates surrounding ICANN work, that would probably be one of the more constructive things to find out compared with what most things get debated.
Right.
And let's see, and for full disclosure, I need to acknowledge that I think it's been under a year, but recently I've signed on as an advisor to a Neustar, which is one of the registry applicants.
Gotcha.
But I'm not speaking for them. I have no authority to, and in fact, I've been discovering how little I know about some of their business activities.
I'm not your lawyer, but I still might counsel you to come gingerly.
Well, actually, it was a fairly carefully calculated statement to indicate that I really don't know a lot of the detail. I want to add one thing sort of off the top. There is an unsung hero in this process, except it gets sung periodically. And I just am repetitively surprised by how important it is, which is the Berkman Center's activities in this regard. This stuff is the real-time work that they're doing.
Can I offer you some candy?
If you haven't been watching me enough in recent years, you know that the shoe is going to fall. No, I actually mean that unqualified. And there's the pamphlet we were handed, which has some interesting stuff in it, and then this paperless society document, which compares applications, which is expressly not a product of the Berkman Center, but is from some people affiliated with the Berkman Center. And this sort of thing, I think, really helps people a lot, and I wanted to highlight two things that I think are unfortunate in the content. Column primarily it's either proof of concept column or the utility column, occasionally contains some language which says that a given, I guess, domain name or business model and domain name may be confusing, and usually it's with reference to .com. And this actually is a segue to this issue about there might be too many unrestricted GTLDs. Well, in fact, GTLDs are unrestricted. That's been the term has been redefined in just the last few months, but for the last 3 years, the term GTLD has referred to unrestricted TLDs. ComNet and org have no registration restrictions affiliated with them, and so when we start worrying about things being confusing, we need to ask whether the world is horribly confused by a .net versus a .com, currently have a couple ccTLDs operating in an essentially unrestricted manner like .cc. And in fact, the motivations for starting the sequence that brought us here today involved more registry and registrar level competition and additional namespace. And so as people debate once again whether we need unrestricted gTLDs, it's important to keep in mind that in fact that was one of the major three goals that created the work that led to where we are today. So I'm in fact more surprised at how many restricted ones there are than unrestricted. And there was the wonderful exchange you were having earlier about how to deal with the registration process when there are additional restrictions shows, I think, how much of an experiment restricted TLDs are. That doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It just means we don't have experience with them, and that they're actually pretty complicated, and that we're going to be going through the learning process with that. But meanwhile, we're 5 years down the pike, and we still don't have any new gTLDs. And if a goal is to get real work done, then one hopes that, as was said earlier, we really do keep focused on continuing. We've had introduction of competition at the registrar level, and we're now trying to add at the registry level. And some people think the stakes are higher, and so it's likely to get a little more interesting as decisions come down the pike.
So let me ask you a question as you wear your technical hat, your IETF hat. We heard in this very venue last year, when gTLD seemed but a distant promise out on the horizon, we heard a lot of discussion and argument about how many top-level domains as a technical matter the root could stand and at what pace they could be added. And for instance, Carl, who's here, and yeah, no doubt say this if I don't, and probably repeat it even when I am about to, will say that we could have 10,000 TLDs. And, you know, there might be political reasons not to or other policy reasons, but as a technical matter, the root could be huge.
Well, I want to explore for a moment the point you just alluded to, which is that there's a range of issues. And given that the very first list of concerns that come out of the ICANN list for evaluation is stability of the Internet, there is a tendency to translate that into only meaning how many names can we put into a root zone. And that's a really extreme simplification. The policy implications affect the administrative operation, which affects the rest of the real-world experience. And stability is a real-world experience. It isn't just how many things can you shove into a root and maybe have it still stand up. It is what's the overall experience as a user of the domain name system in getting things registered, keeping them registered, not having them accidentally handed over to someone else, and so on and so forth. It's
so
a fairly complex thing.
And
I haven't given you the answer yet to that, and I will do that.
I know
you were, but I want to make sure people understand, because I think that the ICANN documents have done a pretty good job, actually, of listing a fairly wide range of things that affect stability, and that a very, very narrow technical point is not the only deciding. Back when this first started being debated in the IAHC time, I started querying a number of additional experts in the matter of DNS technology. And there's just no question at all in anybody's mind who has any knowledge of this technology at all that it can take several thousand. That sort of don't even ask the question, we're done, it's at least several thousand. I think 10,000 is almost as unanimously comfortable. Somewhere up above there, we start getting some divergence of opinion, and we have credible opinions that say 10,000, and credible opinions that say 100 or a million. But we start getting some divergence, and it isn't just what can the database hold, it's what can the network for the function of the root over the entire Internet deal with in terms of traffic and so on.
Right. So let me ask quickly of Richard and Chris, to what extent your business model, which presumes some return on an investment, relies on there not being 10,000 names, or not being 10,000 names, 9,000 of which you have a piece of somehow?
Let me take that first. I think that one of the things that this process is showing, and what we're very excited about, is that the scarcity that exists creates a distorted, I think, view of the value of domain names to a certain extent. And at least when looking at the registry pro bid that we have, which is for professionals, that in fact we will be investing in the TLD.pro, and .pro will mean something. So when you have 10,000 TLDs out there, I think that whether it be 7 or whether it be 10,000 generic top-level domains, I think that the principles are still going to be the same, which is it's going to be a free market. It's going to be one where the registry operators and probably other entities who have a vested interest in seeing that TLD succeed will invest in it, and the TLDs will begin to mean something, as opposed to .com that today doesn't mean anything. .pro will mean something, and .museum will mean something. And I think as we move to a world where TLDs start to mean something, there will be self-selection or desired selection where people will actually choose their TLD because they want to be affiliated with that group. And I think that's what we have the potential to do here, and that's what I'm very excited about.
Yeah, Chris and then Carrie, do you want to say anything, Chris?
Well, our application doesn't rely on there being scarcity at all. In fact, we've been proponents of non-scarcity since day one. We have felt that the scarcity is artificial. We chose the string.web because we feel that it stands on its own regardless of how much competition there is. We welcome the competition. We feel we can market .web regardless of who we're marketing it against.
But just to clarify, in your proposal, there is a period of time for which you would be the exclusive registrar of
well,
that web names?
Well, there was. There is no longer. There was clear consensus on the public comment board that the amount of time that we wanted to take to develop and test our RRP, that's Registry Registrar Protocol System, was too long, and that we would be exclusive for too long. We responded to that criticism. We took it to heart. I went to my technical team, although if you believe the staff report, we don't have one, but
Larry
we do.
Moe and Curley.
Larry Moe and Curley, yes. I went to them, and I said, Larry Moe, how quickly can you get the RRP done, because there's consensus here. And after I wiped the pie from my face, they said, well, 30 to 60 days, I think we can do it, maybe more. And in the answer to ICANN's question, when will you have this, we said, we had anticipated 6 months. We have knocked that down to 30 to 60 days. We think we can knock it down even more.
Yeah.
And that exclusive period will go away.
Yeah. Carrie?
Just something about the impending increase in meaning of TLD string. One of the arguments that's often used to counter the notion of there being any true meaning on that level is that, and you can't search on domains, you can't search .com, you can't search a TLD. What happens when there are enough different TLD strings for the search engine operators, designers, to decide to use these things as indexing terms? What happens when all of a sudden you can search .com? So the potential for this sort of is on this side of the divide, okay, we can argue about it. On the other side of the divide, it becomes a very significant mechanism that we ought to think about harnessing.
Yeah,
I just want to make a clarification because I'm reading the real time. I did not mean to say that we're going to reduce the exclusive registration period to 30 to 60 days. What I mean is that that's how long it will take us to develop our RRP. Actually, if we get it done during the negotiation phase, which is entirely possible, we plan to it, the exclusive period could be zero. I'm not saying that we're mandating that amount of time. The consensus is to get rid of it. That's what we're trying to do.
I don't know if you're the fellow that got sort of bumped at the mic in the last session when they ran out of time, but even if you're not, why don't you ask your question?
Yes. I want to make a couple of comments and then ask a question. First of all, I want to agree with what Steve said, that I'm amazed when ICANN said that be as creative as you can, come up with interesting and original new proposals which are going to help the DNS. Some people came up with and said, I know, we'll have a new unrestricted domain called .info. And someone else came up with another idea, which said, I know, we'll have a new unrestricted domain called .site. And as Steve said, most of the proposed TLDs are completely unrestricted.
I don't know if you typed your name in the thing, just for
yes,
context sake.
I'm sorry,
who
am I? I'm Phil Barron from the Affinity Internet Diss Track application.
Uh-huh.
The other thing is I agree absolutely with Dave that it's a difficult process creating new restricted domains. And specifically what I wanted to comment on is the potential use of the UDRP to create chartered domains. Because everyone, I think, pretty much agrees that UDLP may not be perfect, but it seems to have achieved a lot of things. So it seemed like a natural step to say, okay, well, it's great for the trademark disputes, then surely we can put it into a charter to determine if someone is a real business, a real person, a real doctor, and so on and so forth. And I'd like to point out what I see as being a couple of very serious problems with that. And the first of those is that it's very easy for me to determine if someone is infringing my trademark. My name is Phil Behrendt. If someone starts a site, Phil Behrendt.
Exactly, the more lawyers you bring into it, the harder it is to determine the answer.
Yes, but it's relatively simple. If someone starts a site, philbehrendt.biz, and starts marketing things in my name, then I know my personal rights, my trademark, is being infringed. If, on the other hand, someone has a charter which determines that a given site is a business, and someone registers under that charter and says, I am a business when they register, and the sole sanction of a complainant is to say, no, you're not a business. It's very difficult for someone just looking at a site, it's impossible really, for someone looking at a site to determine whether the site they're looking at is being run by, let's say, a real business, or whether it's being run by a 12-year-old kid who set up a three-page site. And what that means is that because of that difficulty of determination, anything which specifies, which is a chartered approach to a restricted domain, requires a great deal of effort on the part of the complainant to determine whether the party is infringing the charter. And that means that those charters will have no teeth.
I guess among the examples, we have .help, for which certain sites would be deemed appropriate health info and then could make it into the health domain and others would not.
Well, I think the most important one is clearly the one that I've thought most about, this is an applicant for .biz, is the .biz situation. There's one of the applicants that proposed a charter, which are two problems. One of the applicants proposed a charter which said you can only register, and they said we will have a charter. They didn't go into details what that charter will be. And clearly, when one looks in more detail, one sees why they didn't go into details, because proposing a consistent and workable charter turns out to be pretty close to impossible. But the hints that they came up with in their application were that in order to register under this charter, you have to desire to set up to establish a business. If it can be shown that you did not desire to establish a business, then if that can be shown by arbitration, then the domain can be taken away from you. So the questions are, one, how is anyone looking at a site which has been set up by someone under that charter? How is anyone to know, firstly, whether that site is actually belongs to a real business? And even more importantly, how is someone to know whether an unused, a dormant domain name is held by someone that has a desire to set up a business? So, and thirdly, how does one possibly arbitrate on such a nebulous issue?
So let's stop there. And
basically, what I'm saying is, surely it's impractical.
To summarize it.
Surely this is impractical. Surely to use to extend UDRP to cover other issues apart from either very tight issues like the museum situation, where there's a list of museums. All for trademarks is impractical.
Okay, so does anybody want to speak to that? Anybody want to hide under the table?
There aren't too many topics that can be presented that won't get a response.
It is. Well, I'm starting to realize that a number of people are on really good behavior because decisions haven't been made yet. That might be.
You think so?
I mean, I don't mean to be cynical about it, but. So,
I will just say on the issue of charters, I think it is a problem to design a charter and figure out how to enforce it, but I think that is at least if we're talking about proof of concept, and as you pointed out,
Well, yeah, okay, I guess we're fixed. Any broken eardrums? Okay.
Is there a lawyer
careful.
In the audience?
We need .med, not .lawyer. But anyway, I'm sorry, Steve. Go ahead.
Well, as I was saying, I was about to agree with Dave that if we're trying to evaluate proof of concept here, a chartered domain, a restricted domain, is at least a new concept, and there are some there are some some good examples here. I think there are also some good applications here from the perspective of the intellectual property community in the open and generic side, too. So I'm not saying that all of them are bad, but I'm just saying that it was surprising that this is the direction that it took rather than some of the more innovative directions.
So, Louis, am I right in reading that the solicitation of applications was purposely looking for a diversity of ideas here, and in the selection it's the hope of the staff that ICANN will go with a couple really different things and then see what works and what doesn't?
Absolutely.
It's called leading the witness. I don't know what scared Louis today, though.
I'd like to explore the proof of concept issue, because it's been the source of a lot of pain in that I think people have tended to ignore the view that this is a step along the path. The concept of artificial scarcity is actually quite real, and we're trying to fix that. Now, you can fix that by opening a floodgate all at once, in which case you'll get a flood. Or you can try to proceed in a much more deliberated fashion so that there's incremental change, and that's what the proof of concept sequence is. It's not called an experiment, for example, because no one thinks we're going to do the experiment and then get rid of the registration. This is an irreversible process, or at least it had better be, and I think everyone involved in making decisions about this understands that. But the entire idea is there shall be a large number of TLDs. The exact number isn't really the right question, and the exact timing isn't really the right question, although it needs to be reasonably soon. It was supposed to be a couple years ago. And the way to get rid of artificial scarcity is start moving down the sequence. I had what I thought myself was an epiphany this afternoon, thinking about, gee, there's going to be some losers. Gosh. And the epiphany was, is there a way we can turn them not into losers?
Give them their money back, I guess.
That's the wrong answer. And what it occurred to me is, given that this is just one step along the way and there's going to be a continuing process, that people whose rejections are, whose applications are not selected this time, does not mean that, I'm inventing this as you hear it, so no one should take this as any piece of insight on what's really going on. But it struck me as an interesting approach, which is no application is ever rejected.
It's permanently lodged, and
it's,
as
it's
new
lodged.
Stuff comes in, maybe it
well,
will.
The way I would phrase it is, it's not accepted right now. Here are the problems that seem to exist with it that need alteration. And the immediate response I got back, because I was chatting about this idea at lunch, was, but wait a minute, you have people competing for the same domain name. And I'm going, well, if one application gets a domain name and another one doesn't, that's probably something the one that doesn't get it would want to correct in the next version of the application. But the continuing application would nonetheless be, I think, a viable construct.
Yeah. And I don't know. As somebody that read at least chunks of the report, I don't sense anything in it that seems contrary to that. I don't know, Louis, does that seem like a radical idea that these applications are sort of lodged and they stay lodged, and if they at some point become soup, we can eat it?
It doesn't seem radical, but ultimately that's inherent in the proof of concept. I mean, I think what Dave said is right, that it's not an experiment. No one is suggesting we'll ever take one of these back, or at least we hope we never have to. But there could be a proof of concept that has inherent in the idea that some of these categories may turn out to be total failures, and there would be no further steps in those categories.
Although, could you potentially take back, particularly for a TLD that's supposed to be a chartered one, could you revoke it if somehow ICANN sensed an abuse of the charter or the terms under which the TLD was created?
Anything could be done, but I think most people think the responsible thing is to protect the registrants, at least the good faith registrants in a particular domain. There's only been one instance in which I'm aware that there was an attempt to take a TLD back and it failed.
Do you want to say anything more? Or
no. I mean, it was not this kind of TLD, but yes.
Okay, sir.
Yes, Drew Clark with National Journal's Technology Daily. I have two questions. The first concerns the scarcity issue. And I just want a little bit of clarity here on the proposals that you have for these new top-level domains. Your companies would be apparently the exclusive or non-exclusive registry for a period or no period. And could you just explain how the monopoly rent situations for the extremely popular non-trademarked domains? We've heard one example, sex.biz, you know, other popular words, word.biz or whatnot. Who gets who gets to set the price of that? Is it the registry or the registrar? Presuming, of course, that ICANN has no restrictions on who can set the high price of those particular domain names.
Well, in any case where all three properties of the same color are owned, the rents are doubled on unimproved lots. Sorry. I used to love Monopoly. There were a bunch of questions in there. My understanding is that the registry is free to set the price at the registry level, subject to market conditions. The registrar is free to set the markup at the registrar level, subject to market conditions. Currently, we have only competition at the registrar level because Network Solutions is the only one, or should I say VeriSign, to be perfectly correct, is the only registry right now. So that is mandated by contract, and the registrars compete on price. Now we're getting into a point where the registries will be competing on price as well, and you actually have quite an interesting dynamic. Because a registry is going to have to set the price to be competitive, and then the registrar is going to have to set the price. Think of it in terms of wholesaler and retailer, if you want to look at it that way. Does that answer your question?
Just on the high volume names that are not trademarked, who gets the first cut at establishing the price of sex.biz or sex.web?
Okay, I can only speak for our application.
Right.
All our names cost the same. There is no differential between what is attractive and what is not, just like we don't make a definition between what is obscene and what is not. We don't make a distinction between what is a trademark and what is not. We let the UDRP do that. That's what it's for. So if you want to register a really cool name.web, it's the same price as x2j54.web.
I want to give Richard a chance, if he wants to speak to it, and I have a question for Louis.
So, the first question was, will the registries be exclusive? And in both the affiliates and the registry pro application, both registries are exclusive. The second question you asked was, what happens for those really hot names? So someone wants hot.web and someone else wants, let's say Louis and Jonathan both want hot.web. What would happen is the registrars would be entitled to submit the registrations that had been accrued during the post-trademark or post-sunrise, pre-opening up the systems to real-time registration. So let's call it the land rush period. During that land rush period, it would be done on a round-robin basis among registrars, so that if they use different registrars, I know it sounds a little bit confusing, but if they use different registrars, it would be done on a round-robin basis so that the registrar that whose turn came up next, if that application was for hot, they would get it. So it's meant to be done on as equitable basis as is possible using a round-robin allocation.
Louis, let me ask you, somebody again who's kind of canvassed a lot of these proposals. So all of them contemplate leasing rather than buying the domain name by the registrant ultimately. You get it for a year or 2 years, and then you pony up again to keep holding on to it.
By the registrant?
Well, from the registrant's point of view, certainly that's how it usually turns out.
Right.
Pay per year, and often, at least in Continent Nord, the registrar is having to turn around and pay per year as well.
Ask your question again. I missed the point.
The question is, pretty much all the proposals contemplate a yearly renewal in order to keep the name, rather than once you buy it, it's yours, and you can have it till the cows come home.
Nearly all of them do.
And so,
not necessarily yearly.
I gather that one protection against, in our current experience, ComNet and Org suddenly turning to Amazon.com and saying, for your renewal, your fee will be $1 million, and you know, if you don't like it, go to Amazon.biz, no problem. We'll just give Amazon.com to someone else. One protection against that is the fact that there's a deal in place that goes 4 to 8 years that says, no, that's what you have price control. This is the only thing you're allowed to charge. Even then, there's that weird thing about the auction if somebody lets their name slip. So I'm asking now,
is there any limitation for those who do it by the year? Should they change their mind, and once people sort of vest on a given domain name and build up traffic to it, is there anything to stop the registry from telling the registrars the renewal on these names is suddenly double what it used to be, or triple, or quadruple?
Well, there certainly are market acceptance issues there. But in addition, these applicants have made proposals, and they have specified prices they intend to charge. It would seem to me, personally, it would be a breach of faith to do so.
One day change those prices?
To change them in the fashion that you're saying.
They could get a cost of living increase.
Well, or without some upfront disclosure when they made their application to ICANN that that's what they were intending to do.
Gotcha. I don't know, Richard, you're looking like you want to say something.
Yeah, I just want to say that I think that sometimes the high dollar or the high traffic domain names get a lot of press. But in reality, of all the names out there, a lot of them are sort of the worker bees of domain names. You know, less attractive. People have registered them and they need them. And I think that any registry that goes ahead and tries to seed the market and then raise prices after they get market acceptance, like on an Amazon.com example, I think that it's yes, maybe they'll extract the money out of Amazon, so they'll get one customer that's paying a lot, but immediately, every other registrant is going to find a new registry.
Yeah.
Just kind of
spill mine, but is there a quick follow-up?
The second question I had follows really on this question.
Yeah.
Is there any presumption that a non-trademark word that's in a .com top-level domain applies also to a .biz or a .web like Amazon.com? Do they have any first bids on getting Amazon.biz or Amazon.web?
To the best of my knowledge, assuming that it's not a trademark, as you said, it's not a trademark issue, the answer is no.
Gotcha.
Amadeo,
for a quick question.
Hi. It will. Member of the board, but have refused myself from participating in the discussion and the vote on TLDs for historical reasons. There are too many reasons now that can make too many people unhappy for me to participate in that and complicate things further. Now, finally, we are approaching what I really wanted all of you to hear discussing is, the main question for users, finally, is the competition model and the control model that lies behind the TLDs. One thing is the TLD string and, the beauty contest about my rules are better than yours. Another thing is, from the user view, well, once I bought the car, will the car work? And what happens when, I have a problem with the car? And there you're stuck with the registry and then the model that the registrar proposes. Things here. I hope that I can be very careful in giving TLDs to any kind of group that claims to be fully representative. I take the example of the International Council of Museums. I think it's one of the less contested cases we can find. But we always can find a museum in the world that for some historical reasons has some, historical goods and historical problems with Gary and the International Council. We have to make sure that they are not completely on their own to set the rules.
So is this a problem with chartered TLDs generally then? Somebody has to decide who's in and who's out?
Yes. Well, I think the problem is that, it's not saying I am ruling representative is enough. We have to carefully check the rules and the place for, those people to really manage that. The other question is that besides who gets it, is how you manage that. For instance, the International Council of Museums has plays the role of the supporting organization and somehow will have somebody else, CORE and perhaps some others, doing the technical work. The problem with NSI is not that NSI was a strange company. The problem with NSI historically was that the model was very bad. There was a contract that was not fixing the conditions, and up front you can try to fix the conditions today, but over time, those really managing and controlling the data have more and more and more and more and more power. So, the kind of contracts between supporting organizations and registry operators have to be look much closer than they are now and should be much more stringent on the obligations of the registry operator than they are now, because if not, we will develop new strange monopolies with no control out there. Okay?
Another plea for stability as one of the primary criteria.
Yes.
Becca is waving. That means there must be an offline comment. Is that right or no? Yes. So why don't we consider the line here closed? And I don't know if anybody wants to comment quickly on this before we go to the line.
I wanted to underscore the importance of what Amadeo was raising, that especially in the early stages when we're still trying to understand how to get more productive relationships with registries than perhaps we've had in the past, that there's an enormous amount of risk in choosing these initial registries, that they're, therefore the choices probably should be pretty conservative, that looking for some kind of fiscal history that removes or reduces the concern that they will go out of business because they don't know how to manage or don't have enough funding, that there's enough history to the organization that in this realm that they probably know how to do it and do it on the scale that the internet has, that the legal aspects of dealing with them are probably not problematic, that they have some track record of being reasonable to deal with in those regards, and so on.
Interesting. Yeah, sure.
Hi, I'm Jason Hendelis. I'm with ICM Registry. We submitted the proposal for .kids and .xxx. One of the more unique proposals. Yeah. The question I have is, in the ICANN report, it suggests that they'll be accepting additional information. I guess where that leads me to is that none of the proposals were given an opportunity to present their particular business models. And a lot of those proposals, especially in our zone and some of the other zones, are very complex and have an in-depth and detailed consensus-building process that is still ongoing. So the question is are the applicants above, or the applicants here, preparing to submit additional information to support their registry proposals, the first question. And then the second is, does the panel believe that before Thursday any of these recommendations will be influential on the report or the actual board, and how will those recommendations be put forward?
That sounds like the question is there a lot more paperwork about to happen as the last minute rush towards Thursday happens?
Well, Jason, I'm really fortunate on this answer because I'm covered by confidentiality agreement, so I can't address whether we're going to be submitting more information or not. And what was your other question?
Does it matter?
That sort of negates the second one.
I think we feel that our application stands on its own and we don't need to submit any more information with the exception of the corrections that we submitted to the public comment board based on just factual inaccuracies. To answer your second question, I have no idea. I often lay awake at night wishing I could read the minds of the board, but I can't. So I don't know what they're thinking and what they will do. I would be concerned that more paperwork before Thursday just underscores the vast, vast amount of work that the board has to do between last Friday when the staff report was released and this coming Thursday when they're supposedly going to actually make the decision. That's a lot of work.
If you had your druthers, would you rather there be a delay or would you just as soon get it over with?
Would a delay facilitate a more fair and open and thorough process?
This is sort of a Palm Beach kind of question. We don't know.
Do I want a manual recount?
Yeah.
Is what you're asking?
You keep counting, you keep getting different answers.
Well, I mean, in light of not having an opportunity to present your particular proposal, I mean, wouldn't you want...
So you're saying in light of the fact that the consultation period was canceled?
Yes.
If it would create a more fair and open process, and I it's a mantra, but I must repeat, fair and open and transparent process, absolutely, I wouldn't have a problem with it at all. We've waited 5 years to get this far. If another couple months makes it work smoother, fine.
Richard, you seem to...
Yeah, one thing I do want to comment is, you know, when the first registrars were accredited, of which Registrar.com was one of them, I think that there was a lot of consternation of who was selected and why were they selected. You know, but we now have an environment where there are how many accredited registrars, Louis?
Hundred
169 accredited registrars with new applications coming in, I guess, every week or every couple of weeks. So there's a robust application process that people are buying into, and it's been worked out. I think that one of the things that was a wise decision was it's always easy to stay delayed because not making a decision sort of, you know, means you don't have to deal with the consequences. But I think that the sooner that we get on the task and the sooner that we as a community and I can get on with the task of creating competition in the registry space, the better off we will be, and we can move to the next level of development and really make the domain name space what it has the potential to be. Yeah. But I think that delaying at this point in time is only going to create other problems, and in 6 months from now, and I'm hoping that the board will approve new registries, whether they're mine or not, hopefully that they will approve new registries. I think 6 months from now we'll look back on this and say it was the right thing to do because it started the process and got it going.
Yeah. Chris, for a real quick comment before we move to the next question.
Right. I have to respectfully disagree a little bit in that the addition of registrars and the addition of registries is apples and oranges. It's very different. And to hurry up with registries, especially in the case where with a registrar you do not have an exclusivity constraint. With a registry, you do. The stakes are much higher, if you will. To take extra time and be more deliberate and do it right, I think plays paramount importance to hurrying up and then see how it goes with just a few.
Gotcha.
I think real quick, please. No, I mean, I guess I'm sort of hoping for some of the other panelists to respond to part of the idea, which is, do you think that if the applicants are provided an opportunity or submit responses, let's say today or tomorrow, how or do you think is there a way that those responses are going to be put forward?
I think it is possible, and in fact it's trivial, to criticize any process that involves people, and that we could find a good reason for delaying any of these steps at any point in time. We would never make any progress. When we talk about hurrying up the registry allocation, we're talking about hurrying up after 5 years of delay. And I think that what we need to do is stop viewing this as a winner-take-all event on Thursday. There's going to be more and more and more. There will not be more and more and more unless we start. The sooner we start, the sooner we'll get more.
Okay.
If I can just ask something, I think it's responsive there. One of the, one of the things I hope can happen over the next couple of days, if, you know, is to meet with as many, it is from the IPC's perspective, we're eager to meet with as many of the applicants as possible to try to understand better some of the things we found ambiguous in the applications, and if that leads to a change in our evaluation, we'll certainly let the ICANN staff and board know.
Gotcha. Thank you.
My name is Radar Wasenius. I represent the Nokia Corporation. We submitted an application for a TLD optimized for mobile use. And I'm here precisely of what Dave was saying. Regardless of what actually happens in this round, for us, this is clearly a beginning of a lot of discussions and development going on and dialogues going on with lots of people. I just deleted all my questions, so I'll just...
Well, what a happy coincidence.
No, on purpose. No, I was just saying, on purpose, because I'm looking at my watch.
I'm sorry, did you say you were a registry applicant?
I'm saying...
He intentionally deleted his question.
Oh, I'm telling you, I just deleted my question because we're running out of time, so I'll just give you a very crystallized comment to say that for us, obviously... For the intern community, decisions must now be made. So, but regardless of that, we think it would be important to utilize the huge amount of ideas that have been generated, both from the applicants as well as in the public forum and so forth at this stage. And since we have lots of experience of creating international fora, associations and such, for developing new standards and stuff, we think that it would be really important to not make a really sharp distinction between so-called winners and losers, but instead open up now, utilize all the ideas, and continue discussions to develop, for instance, from our point of view, a mobile internet TLD.
Thanks. I'm going to want to close the panel by asking each of you to visualize next year, this time, repressing issues 3, and to be able to tell us what you think the state of affairs will be at that time. But while you think about that, let's get our last question.
One last question. I'm Dmitry Dukovny from .yp, or eventually perhaps a non-existent entity based on its current review in this Berkman paper. I don't know if any of you have read it. But
Berkman student paper.
Berkman student paper. Yeah. And I do
think I have to grade at some point.
My apologies.
Yeah.
In any case,
I can give an F as easily as an A. No problem for me.
But the actual point of the question was, it seems ICANN is being ill-served by various of the people who are trying desperately to serve it. So what exactly is going to be the final analysis? What kind of exclusion criteria will be granted to the various people who will be excluded at the end of the process? And when that happens, what kind of response period will be allowed? I raised a lot of questions also, and this is the one that everybody asked by email while we're sitting over there.
And does it seem that this is best directed at Louis? Is that the...
Actually, probably.
Oh, sure, Louis. Happy to
and
help.
Well, you are from Council, right?
Yes. No, that was the question?
That was, in fact, the question.
Okay, I don't understand what you mean by exclusion.
Well, we didn't all pay $50,000 to be dismissed out of hand, hopefully. Right?
I don't think anybody's been dismissed out of hand.
Exactly. All right. So given that, what kind of response is actually going to be allocated to those who have been excluded in the first analysis?
Well, the board makes the selections for negotiation. I guess I don't understand
when
the context of your question.
So should the board, for whatever reason,
not
choose a particular applicant
for further negotiation,
is there a consolation prize?
Not necessarily a consolation prize, but what sort of discussion will actually be opened after that point with those who were not selected for negotiation?
This kind of cuts to Dave's musings, too, about is there some way that you could come back to fight another day and not have to put in another $50,000?
Well, that's something for me to say, and that's, again, up to the board. And the finances of ICANN. We operate on a cost recovery basis. So
they've already spent the money, is what he's trying to say.
All right. What about in the midst of this particular process, will there actually be a clear statement of reasons for exclusion?
Well, I think the community, the public forum, there will be comments. There have been comments here. The ICANN process, by its nature, is open, transparent, community-based, which means that authoritative voices are not easily found. And that's inherent in the process.
Okay, so let's move to our closing musings. I'm curious to know, thank you for the question. I'm curious to know, let's just start and go right down the line. It's a year later, we're in some hotel not far from here, some radius of LAX, we've gathered together again, we're going to record these for the record and play them back at you next year and see how accurate you are. How many top-level domains do you think there will be, and what will the general state of affairs be? Chris?
Can I wear my rose-colored glasses for this answer?
Please.
Mine? My rose-colored glasses. We're here next year. All 44 applicants were given one TLD apiece because 44 is an extremely small number when it comes to a proof of concept. There are no losers. Some of them have failed miserably. Some of them have succeeded wildly. The internet continues to run. The ones that failed, we might look back with hindsight and say, wow, we couldn't have predicted this. It wouldn't have been our job to predict it. Those that succeeded will continue to run just fine, and the internet will route around the problems. Prices will have been determined by market forces. And for the most part, everybody will be happy. That's my rose-colored outlook for where we should be next year.
Very good. Richard.
Well, I share a lot of Chris's sentiments, unqualified, in terms of what's going to happen. I think that I'd estimate fewer TLDs, probably 15 to 20 new top-level domains will be created over the next 12 months. Users will start affiliating themselves with different TLDs or community groups as is appropriate. And I think what's important from the internet and from most people that are sitting here that care about the internet, I think that companies such as the registries and the registrars are going to commit substantial funds in order to market and sell names to all these various groups, which is then going to drive adoption and use of other internet products and services. And I think that a lot of what ICANN set out to do when it was formed about 2 years ago will have been accomplished, which is really creating a very competitive namespace at both the registrar and the registry level.
Gotcha. Okay.
I'll abstain from speculating on the number of new TLDs that might be in existence. I'm assuming that it's going to be a lot smaller than what will happen 2 years from now. and we're obviously going to be in some process of what went right, what went wrong evaluation. And my fondest hope would be that during that we would see some opportunity for proactive cultivation of domain namespace, not just some who would like what be creative, but that there are clear niches which have manifested themselves as fruitful areas for further what we would development, and that we could be talking about that as well.
I see that there would be far fewer than 44, but I don't know how many. And I hope that some of the money, if it all hasn't been spent, will of the $2.5 million that ICANN has recently received in relation to this, would be devoted to a thoughtful evaluation and compliance effort. Because many statements are being made in these applications that about how the TLDs will be run, and I think it's very important that we, when we convene a year from now, we know to what extent those have been kept and what problems have been encountered.
Gotcha. Dave?
I envision two different scenarios a year from now, and I wish I had a strong sense of which was more likely, but I don't. The pessimist in me envisions one in which those who have been trying to block the process will continue to do that through litigation or through this peculiar situation that permits the U.S. government or, gee, as we've been hearing, the California government to dictate details about what really is a global resource, and that they will actually exploit those sources of leverage and not really pay much attention to how totally unproductive that is for everybody, including them. The other scenario is more hopeful, that we will have completed a second round of allocations. And I don't really care very much what the number is. I mean, I think it will be more, and frankly, that's all that counts, that we will have gotten enough learning under our belt that the furor and the animosities will have gone away, and we will just be doing business, and that the domain name system issues will be once again as boring as they were when John ran them.
Louis?
Well, I don't think it's, unfortunately, not appropriate for me to speculate on how many new ones, but I am pretty confident that the 253 existing TLDs will still be in the rear year.
So we can all breathe a sigh of relief at that. And I'm hoping that this time next year we'll gather again. I don't know if it'll be a bigger crowd or if things have gotten boring, a smaller crowd, to have as good a day of reflection as we've managed to have today, and setting the stage for what will be an interesting week with ICANN. So please join me in thanking the panelists for a very difficult job completed quite well.